how lucky it is just to like get through a day without pain.
If you look at me, it doesn't appear that I have a disability.
A test that comes back abnormal, it's like, yes, we're onto something here.
Welcome to Major Pain. I'm your host, Jesse Mercury, and this week we'll be speaking with Rashira Dobson, host of the Womanhood and Disability podcast, about being born around 5 months premature and needing over 100 surgeries to fill in the gaps for where her body was not fully developed. Rashira has been diagnosed with two rare conditions related to her being born premature. The first is Vader syndrome. According to the ClevelandClinic.org, Vader syndrome is a group of growth abnormalities or birth defects that happen in the early stages of embryo development during pregnancy. The term Vader is an acronym that identifies parts of the body that didn't form properly during fetal development. Rashira was also born with Goldenhar syndrome. Continuing from ClevelandClinic.org, Goldenhar syndrome is a rare congenital condition. Congenital means it's present at birth. It's a type of craniofacial condition, meaning it causes irregularities in the shape or development of your face or head. Specifically, Goldenhar syndrome typically affects your spine, ears, and eyes. For the first 2 decades of her life, Rashira had surgery after surgery, including a lot of trial and error as her doctors tried to figure out how to allow her body to support itself, and thankfully is now in a place where that is the case. Rashira's resume as an activist is incredibly impressive. She'll tell us about her mission to spread messages of justice, advocacy, disability empowerment, and awareness. As Rashira is a podcaster herself, this is not her first time being on a podcast, and it shows. She is a pro, and she did such an incredible job telling her story today. Her story is unlike anything we've heard before on the podcast, and I'm thrilled and honored to be featuring Rashira on the podcast today. We'll get to her story in just a couple minutes. I'm going to keep my intro brief this week since I'm currently in the midst of a flare-up, and trying to speak without slurring my words is a real challenge right now. But there is something really important that I want to talk about before we jump into our conversation with Rashira today. Last year, I wanted to start a new tradition that when we kick off a new season, I would go through our complete list of everyone supporting this show on Patreon. And last week was our season premiere, and I did not remember to do so. So this week, I want to go through and thank every single person who signed up on Patreon. This year, I did add a free subscription tier on Patreon. So let's start with those folks. Thank you so much, Angela, Debbie, Firebird Free, Joe, John, Christy, Laura, Madre, Melanie, and Tanya for signing up at our free subscription tier. Next up is our $2 per month supporters, Christina, Nate, Isabel, Karen, Laura, Leslie, Soph, Stitchspin, and Sue. Our $7 per month patron tier, thank you to Alexandria Henderson, Heather Muncy, Justin Minnick, Kelsey Mattson, Naomi Adele Smith, Robert, All Around Foundation Waterproofing, and some special folks that preferred to remain anonymous. And finally, our $25 per month producer tier, Steve Cavanaugh, Chris Fowler, Trish O'Brien, and Hipster Leia. Of course, I thank our producers at the beginning of every show, and you can hear the names of our patron and producer tier at the very end of every show. But once a year, I just want to stop and take a moment to thank every single person on Patreon because your support means the world to me. The financial support I receive through Patreon absolutely keeps this show going. It is vital and crucial to the life of this show. Thank you so much to every single one of you for helping to keep this project going. If you'd like to support Major Pain on Patreon, you'll gain access to monthly bonus episodes, special recognition on the show, and even gifts when you sign up. You can learn more at patreon.com/majorpainpodcast. Everything else you need to know about supporting this show, you can find on our website at majorpainpodcast.com/support. And with that, we'll jump into our incredible episode with Rashira Dobson, who shares her story of being born about 5 months premature and living with Vader and Goldenhar syndromes. Rashira, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
Yeah, I just found you on Instagram recently, and I was like, I really want to interview this person. I'm so thrilled that it's happening so quickly. I know that you have a podcast yourself. I haven't had the chance to listen to it yet. So what is your podcast? Please tell us about it.
Yes, my podcast. My podcast is entitled The Womanhood and Disability Podcast. And it really talks about the intersection of lived experiences of women with disabilities. I am a woman with a disability and a chronic illness. And so I've kind of learned from my own personal journey that there are some things that have been unique to my, I guess, evolution into becoming a woman that has been differently from my able-bodied friends or my sisters, my coworkers, who are also women. And so I really just wanted to create space and community for women with disabilities to share our stories, our experiences, for healing, for growth, and just for overall support. So I'm on Spotify, Apple, most of all the platforms where you can find podcasts. and we just dropped a new episode March 25th. And so I'm really excited about that one. But yeah, I have the opportunity to not only share my personal dialogues about some things I have experienced in my life, but also, like I said, bringing on different women from different arenas, industries, backgrounds, disability types. And we're just having this conversation together about womanhood and disability.
Wow, so cool. I'm so excited to check it out. I was just telling you before we started recording, I'm going on a trip tomorrow. So I know what I'm going to download now to listen to. yeah, I'm so excited about that. It sounds like we have a lot in common and some similar ideas about what we want to put out into the world as far as our podcasts are concerned. And you mentioned you have a chronic illness and a disability. I'm very excited to hear your story and learn all about that. Before we get into that, let's get to know you a little bit. So, Rashira, why don't you tell us about yourself?
Oh, man, I feel like that's such a hard question to answer. But yeah, a little bit about me. I mean, you know that I'm a podcaster. I create a lot of social media advocacy posts just around how to bring awareness to disability. And then outside of that hat, I always say I wear many different hats. By day, I'm a full-time PhD student. My background's in public health. And so my research interest is actually looking into the health outcomes of women and girls with disabilities and how social stigma influences that.
Wow.
And along with my title being a student, of course, I'm a researcher. I'm also a public speaker. I'm a self-published author 2 times.
Wow.
You can find my books on Amazon. My first book is my memoir entitled Beauty with a Twist, where I chronicle my long life journey of living with a disability and chronic illness. And then my second book, which I just released of November of 2023, is called Different Like Me. It is a small children's book. And just creating representation for other Black and brown girls with disabilities who don't often see themselves in storybook pages. And so I think at the core, I'm a creative. I like to create different types of content and engaging with people and communities and just really doing what I can in my fair share to bring advancement to the overall disability, chronic illness, rare disease community, all enmeshed into one.
Whoa, I'm impressed. You're a real mover and a shaker. You're getting things done over there. What do you do for fun? How do you blow off steam? What are you nerdy for?
Oh, man. I love movies. I'm a big, like, Marvel movie, DC girl. I love sci-fi movies. Most of the trilogies I've probably watched more times than, you know, a non-nerd would be careful to admit. I also like to travel. I like trying new foods and new places to eat. Anytime that I travel, I always like finding the most hole-in-the-wall or trendiest restaurants because I feel like we understand cultures and community by the food that they eat. So I love to travel. And yeah, just spending time with family and friends and just, I feel like my life is really intertwined with my purpose. So even when I'm like blowing off steam and I'm doing air quotes since you all can't see me, it's always somewhat aligned and just, I don't know, just making disability, I wouldn't say seem cool, but just living my life with joy, with purpose and with intent. That's really important.
Amazing. I love that so much. What a great message. And I also love science fiction. I don't know if you saw my eyes light up when you said that, but my podcasting career started with a couple of shows about science fiction. That's my deep, deep passion.
Really?
Yeah. What's your favorite sci-fi?
Oh man, so I don't know, you guys are going to probably like judge me and be corny for this, but I have a personal reason for this. So I'm a really big fan of the Hunger Games trilogy, and that is because I have so much similarity between the character of Katniss Everdeen.
Wow.
And so I guess like in the trilogy series, I think I have probably watched that more times than I can count. And I always feel weird for saying like I'm a big sci-fi person because I prefer watching sci-fis over like rom-coms, chick flicks. Like I'm a total sci-fi action girl. Give me all the weird storylines over any mushy, predictable storylines. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that makes sense because you're very socially conscious. A lot of your work is about society and shaping and molding society, particularly in the way that people with disabilities are viewed. And that's, you know, I'm like grew up on Star Trek. I'm obsessed with Star Trek and just this idea of like this utopian future and thinking about what we want our future to look like now shapes what our present is. And that's what I love about science fiction. So totally makes sense to me. I love that. Okay, well, let's jump into your health journey. So Rashira, what is your major pain?
Oh, man. Let me see if I can list like one of them. I always say that living with a disability is not hard. Society makes it hard. The way that they treat people with disabilities, the stigma around disability, the inaccessibility around disability, especially in our healthcare system, I think that is what makes disability hard. Because especially for someone like me, who is born with a disability, you know no other way of living, right? I've only known my disabled body, and I've acclimated and I've adapted to living within my disabled body. And there are many nuances that comes with having both invisible and visible disabilities. And so that part does not make it hard for me, but it is society's response that makes it hard for me.
Yeah, like your disability isn't your major pain. It's the way society reacts to it that is your major pain.
Yeah,
that's very absolutely. Well said. I love that. Yeah. Do you mind sharing what is your disability?
So I was born with two really rare conditions. The first one is called Bader syndrome. It's a long acronym. You guys will probably have to Google it. And the second one is Golden Horror syndrome. And that is referred to mostly as a subset of conditions that consist of birth defects and abnormalities that affect the head and or the face. And so Golden Horror is typically the more visible one that people tend to see. However, Bader syndrome is a more invisible one that people do not see.
Is that Bader as in like Darth Vader?
Vater, I need to enunciate a little bit more, but V-A-T-E-R-S.
Okay. Basically, pronounced the same way, like water with a V, Vader's syndrome.
Exactly.
Vader's syndrome is the one that is less visible. What does that entail?
So those consist of internal abnormalities and birth defects. Like, so it looks at, I was born with heart defects. Digestive defects, spinal defects.
Wow.
I was born, I actually don't remember how many weeks premature. I think I was around 4 or 5 months born prematurely. So a lot of my body was underdeveloped when I was born. And so that's what the Vader syndrome, the acronym is like vertebro for the V, anal for the A, tracheal for the T, esophageal for the E, renal for the R, and then of course S is for syndrome. And so all of those different traits and characteristics describe what Bader syndrome is. I have all of the characteristics except the R, so I do not have any type of kidney, renal, or spinal abnormalities.
Wow. You've mentioned that you've adapted to these things, and it's all you've ever known. But it must impact your life in ways that you've just integrated in countless ways.
Yeah, most definitely. So over the course of my life, I've had 104 surgeries. A lot of those were immense reconstruct because I was born so premature. From the time I was born, my mom says that my first surgery was 18 hours long, a few hours shortly after I was born. And then I was just on this journey of having lifelong surgical procedures to basically fill in the gap to where my body was not fully developed. And then, of course, I was born in 91, so a lot of medical technology was not where it is today. And so it was a lot of trial and error within a lot of those surgical procedures, a lot of things that had to correct themselves on its own or through surgical interventions, trying, of course, multiple times. A big chunk of the surgeries, I do not remember. I do remember coming across one medical record that said by the time I was six, I had 69 surgeries to date. I don't remember those first 69, of course, because I was really young. But I think I started to remember what the surgical processes was like, definitely from age seven and up, and kind of, how it created that level of hardship, I guess you would say.
Yeah, wow. Can you give us some specifics about, let's say, the heart defects, just so we can kind of get an idea? I mean, obviously, we don't need to go organ by organ and talk about your body in that way, because that feels...
It'll take forever. Yeah,
that feels like it's not the right way to go. But, the heart is, the central organ of the body, pumping everything to everywhere else. So, do you mind telling us a little bit about your heart?
Yeah, so with my condition, I was born with what they call VSDs, which are basically holes that appear in the heart.
Wow.
Those are referred to as defects. Three of them closed on their own, and then one had to be surgically closed. And then alongside with that, some of the heart issues I've had, there was a time in my life, probably from the age of like 6 to 10, I was having surgery close to every 6 to 8 weeks, which caused the valves in my heart to become weakened. For those of you who do not know, every time you go under anesthesia, it's really not good for your body. It weakens your body. It weakens your immune system. And so at that point, I had just become very susceptible to infection and just had a very weak body. And so I ended up getting some infection in my heart. And I remember I had open heart surgery at the age of 7 years old.
Wow.
And so those are just like one of the things that I can probably connect to a birth defect that I was born and then resulting in an actual surgical intervention. I don't have any heart issues to date, thank God.
Wow.
I'm typically a really healthy person. I do think a lot of the more intense like surgical interventions and medical treatments I got happened when I was a lot younger, because when kids are younger, they're more fragile, they're more susceptible to weakness and different things. And so there just had to be a point where I had to grow out of a lot of those types of intense treatments and things.
Yeah, wow, that's so intense. Just thinking about growing up having surgery every 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And your doctors are just trying to keep ahead of all of these ways in which your body was underdeveloped from being born premature. But once you catch up with that, it's like you're running this marathon after marathon, but once they catch up with it, all of a sudden your body is now functioning on its own. And it's amazing to hear you say, now I'm a healthy person. That's so cool.
Yeah, which can be like, it can be a really like, I think, conflicting message oftentimes when people see me, because, they see like someone who is able-bodied and who's functioning, who's thriving, but they don't see the years of surgeries I had to endure to be able to get through this point. And even so much now, like I still consider myself very much immunocompromised. Like, I'm the first person to get sick. I have COVID. I had COVID multiple times. I just think that's a part of some of the disparate effects that happens when you are immunocompromised and have been through so many surgical procedures. You just generally have an overall weaker immune response to someone who's typically hasn't gone through all the crap that I've gone through.
Yeah.
So I guess that can also be a major pain.
Totally. Wow. So interesting. Okay. So that's the Vader syndrome, and that's like the internal, I keep thinking of Darth Vader, which I'm kind of jealous that your disease sounds like Darth Vader. And then what was the name of the second condition, the more visible of the two?
So the name of the second condition is called Golden Har, H-A-R. I like to say Golden Heart, because most people think when they hear of it. But this is the craniofacial condition that it results in the in me having an ear deformity, and why my face is slightly asymmetrical. And yeah, I think those are the two main things that people tend to notice.
Golden har. And
yes.
Is this condition also a result of being born premature?
Yeah, you know, it's really weird because even today, they say it's just like a phenomenon that happens in the womb, you know, where my ear just did not develop. The entire right side of my face is underdeveloped. I have nothing but soft tissue. So I have a lot of like oral mouth. I've had over 30 something reconstructive surgeries just on my jaw alone. I was born without a right jawbone. So that's kind of more internal too. So yeah, it's also really complicated.
Yeah, totally. And also you are living at the intersection of visible and invisible illness, which I have oscillated between the two over my journey, where I'm mostly invisible. And then there's been times where it's like super visible. And the way that people treat me differently is so incredibly striking, you know?
Yeah.
Like if I'm flared up and I'm outside in my wheelchair, the way that people talk to me is, it couldn't be more different. And people are so friendly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But also like really demeaning sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, like speaking to me as if I'm a child, or they see a wheelchair and they assume that my brain is underdeveloped. Mm. And I'm like, well, that might be true. I don't know. But it has nothing to do with the wheelchair, you know? That's unrelated. So that's something that's very personal to me, and I'm very interested in. And I want to talk about that when we talk about like growing up and that juxtaposition of the visible and the invisible. Before we jump into that part of your story, I'm really curious to hear about the cumulative effect. Like, how do you feel right now about your journey? Do you have medical PTSD? Do you have feelings about, definitely. It sounds like if you weren't born premature, it sounds like most of this would not have happened. Like this, is that correct? Like, this is not a genetic condition. This is like an acquired condition that was acquired at birth because you were born early. I could imagine feeling one of two ways about that. I could imagine feeling angry, like this thing happened to me. I could also imagine feeling grateful. I survived. I had all this medical care and now I'm feeling healthy. And I'm so curious which side or both sides you land on.
Yeah, I think it's both sides and probably more. And I think on this side of my life, I'm so thankful for therapy because there is so much compounded trauma.
Yeah.
And I think you really realize the effect of that trauma until the older you get. I remember being in high school and even college, I think there is always a level of possibly disassociation because you're just happy for it to just be over. You know, I remember in college, like I was not having intense surgeries anymore. And so I just totally like dashed, like I didn't want to be seen because growing up, I was just seen as the medically fragile girl, the sick girl, the one who's always having surgery. And I felt like, you know, I felt like a freak. I did. And excuse my French, but I felt like a freak. Like, you know how they would describe freaks back in the day, like in circus time? That's what it felt like. Because people would try to sensationalize and phenomenalize my story. And, oh, the girl with 100 surgeries. It's like, I didn't want to be that. And so I ran away very hard from that, I guess, identity marker. But I finally had to come to a place where I had to accept that that was a part of my experience. And so it was a lot of confronting and, like I said, unpacking and really sitting in the fact that, girl, you've had a lot of surgeries. like you spent your childhood like really in a hospital and you've gone through more than a lifetime's worth. I've had more surgeries than I've lived my life. Double the times, almost triple. That's a lot to wrap your mind around.
Absolutely. And you mentioned being born 1991. How old are you now?
I'm 32.
32. Great. Thank you for saving me the math.
Yeah. No, I get it mixed up. But I was like, if you do the math, that means I've had 4 to 5 surgeries per year since birth. Having one surgery per year is hard enough. Having 4 to 5, like,
yeah.
And so I think it's something it's like a disproportionate fraction that will never make sense to me. And so I think, of course, there are levels, like I said, of that anger, like, God, this happened to me. Like, why did you let this happen to me? But also in just recognizing the sovereignty of what has happened to me and learning how to move forward. And I think on this end of my disability, again, doing air quotes, chronic illness journey, I have really embraced of living life really intentionally and purposefully, because I understand what pain is. I understand what suffering is. I don't ever have to read it in a book, because I literally have embodied it for decades. And so now I really try to live my life in focusing on things that bring me joy, things that bring me peace, things that make me feel good, things that allow me to center my life and my identity outside of what I've experienced. And I think that is something that oftentimes people within our community, we miss out on, because sickness is so consuming. It can consume every part of your life and your identity if you let it. But if you're ever able to find pockets and spaces where you're not sick just for 1 second, I would say dive deep into it, because sickness will have its own place. But joy, we have to intentionally create those moments of joy and those places of peace and those places that we are not suffering, so we can get through the suffering that we know might be coming our way.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I couldn't agree more. And those are similar conclusions that I drew while I was so sick. It's like, what do I do? You know, how do I get through this? And finding ways to cultivate joy was a huge part of it. And I say all the time on this podcast, joy is cumulative. And the more you purposefully immerse yourself in it, the more your body starts to recognize it and allow it to be the state that you're in. It's, you know, being in a chronic illness, you kind of fall into all these grooves like a record player, and it's really hard to get out of them. But you can also purposefully build good grooves that you fall into that get easier and easier to maintain within.
Yeah.
What are your first memories of your health journey?
That's a good question. I think my first memories of my health journey are really centered around my body. And just feeling like my body was a consistent object of pain. Wow. To the point, I had a feeding tube up until I was 16. I don't know any other 16-year-old who had a feeding tube, but I had one, and it was such a pain because it would leak and get infected, and it was just like just a pain. But I just remember of having devices connected to me that would cause pain, whether that was an IV or a feeding tube or a pick line, just always having some type of instrument, and then having my body used as an instrument would thus inflict pain. And so I say those would be like some of my earliest memories. But on the good side of that, like, is there a good side? Yes, there is. I also remember a lot of comfort from my mom. Whenever I would be in a hospital, she would bring a blanket from home from my room. My mom's a super girly girl, so our blankets always had some sorts of ruffles, flowers, bears, something super girly. And I would probably be the only child in that entire floor who would have like a big pastel bright colored blanket with Winnie the Pooh, flowers, Barbie, something on it that was just so loud. But in the midst of that loudness, it was so much comfort, because I was like, if I didn't have anything else in this hospital, I have this blanket that's going to keep me warm, and that gives me a little piece of home. So I think on the good side, that memory was comfort, and on the bad side, the memory of medical tools in my body being used as a tool. That's really deep. That should probably be a book or something.
Yeah, totally. Tell me about being young and being treated differently. Your major pain is the way people treated you. How did that shape your childhood, let's say, you know, throughout elementary school and growing up? Like, kids are mean. I can't imagine, you know, having to have medical devices on you and going to elementary school. That must have been very difficult.
Yeah, I would say like kindergarten probably through fourth grade, kids were nice. You know, they wanted to patronize me, you know. And one time in the first grade, because I was having so many surgeries, I had to use a wheelchair. And so, you know, kids would volunteer to wheel me into the cafeteria and sit me at the table, you know. And at the time, it seemed sweet because, you know, everyone wants to be my friend. I didn't realize how patronizing it was. But, you know, I would get, like, the principal award just for just being in the wheelchair. Looking at it, I'll probably cringe and be like, that probably wasn't the best way to go. But when I was in first grade, it felt good to get that level of attention. It didn't start to become stigmatizing until fourth, fifth grade, in which my difference became not a source of inspiration, but a source of exclusion, in which kids began to say, we're like this and you're like that, you know, that separation. I remember getting teased a lot in fifth grade for people saying I talk like a Chinese person, which I guess was the equivalent of me not being able to speak clearly because I had, I was in speech therapy, saying my face is like a gorilla, you know, that was really hurtful. Wow. Kids not wanting to touch me because they said I had a disease and I didn't want to become infected. I mean, they were really messed up. But I would say that I also had a really strong mother, a really strong Black mother that that didn't go on for long. So at the point that I did experience like bullying and things like that, it only took me to cry and come home crying one time for my mom to be like, y'all are not about to torture my child at school. And so I will say that I didn't experience a lot of bullying and teasing on that level. But I will say when I became an adult and I didn't necessarily have that safeguard of my parents to advocate for me, I think that's when I began to experience a lot of that stigma and discrimination, because now I don't have my mom, like, you know, protecting my disabled child. It was my disabled self protecting my disabled self. And that was incredibly difficult, especially as a young adult trying to find my place in the world.
Yeah. I that must be such an incredibly difficult transition to make. What was that like to step out on your own and to, you know, be in charge of yourself? Was that when you went off to college? Did you move away from home? What was the situation?
Yeah, when I went off to college, that's when I started doing things more on my own. And it was completely terrifying. I had no idea what I was doing. And I felt like for 10 years, I always tell people, like, you could not pay me to go back to my 20s because my 20s were incredibly difficult. I felt like I was underwater or barely keeping my head above water at all times. I did not realize the harsh reality of being, like you said, a child transitioning into the adult realm of what it's like to live with a disability, and some of the craziest things people would say or assume about me, about my ability, about my family. You know, people assuming that my parents were disabled because I had a disability. People going in for job interviews and never turning back. And not just that happening one or two times, but multiple times. Like, people would just ghost at me because it was that assumption, like, on resume, she looks great, but, you know, if we're a rich retail store, can we hire her? Are people going to look at her different because she's different? You know, that level of stigma. Even stigma when it came to, you know, social and romantic relationships, like either not existing or having a hard time to exist because people are not able to separate me being a disabled person, but having value and also being separate from my disability. And so, they were really... there were a lot of years in there that were extremely painful that, again, I thank God for therapy because we're unpacking this. But there was no amount of warning anyone could have gave me to prepare me for that level of shame and stigma that I would have to experience.
Yeah, how do you even start to process through that? I mean, the way that you talked about your work at the beginning of the podcast, I'm so impressed. Like, what you're doing is incredible. But you've obviously powered through that and gone to this place where you are strong and in control and in charge and doing incredible work. How do you make that transition?
Yeah, it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of tears that people don't see me crying. It's a lot of therapy sessions. It's a lot of, like, I like to call God conversations, like me wrestling with God, asking him hard questions and him answering me back. you know, I'm a Christian. I live my life. I'm a faith person. And so I think faith has also been a really integral part of how I'm able to power through that. It's because when you're able to connect your suffering to a larger purpose, I think that makes it worth it. And so for me, I had to attach that suffering or that experience to something bigger than myself. And I think that helps grounds me a lot in my perspective and my worldview. You know, nowadays people see the accolades, they see the platform, they see the stages, they see all the great things I do. And not taken away from their greatness, but with every big stage becomes a very small hole of a lot of deep and intense work. And if you do not do the work, despite if you get on the stage, it won't last. And you will forget why you're on the stage in the first place.
So wise. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so for me, I'm grateful to have those experiences to pull from. So when society decides to go left or culture trends shift, I'm always connected to the deeper why. I do this work not to become famous. I know someone said to me a few weeks ago, you know, we can do it for your podcast. I was like, that will always happen because I didn't create my podcast to become famous. I created my podcast to build community where there was not a community for me.
Yeah.
So staying connected to that why is so important, and it's what grounds me.
Yeah. I don't think any of us making chronic illness content are concerned about being famous. You know, maybe I'm sure there are some, but it's not, it's not the field to get into if you want to be famous.
It's not.
Yeah. No, it is all about building community and, you know, advocating on behalf of the people like you or like me, people who, you know, going through something similar, who we know from experience, like the infrastructure of support isn't there. So maybe we can help build that a little bit by doing this public work. I mean, you and I definitely share that in common. At what age did your surgeries start to taper off?
I will say about 17, 18.
Okay. So by the time you get into this really difficult period in your 20s, your surgeries are pretty much over and done with. Your body has been stabilized. All of the issues from being born so premature have been sort of, you know, dealt with the best that your doctors knew how. How premature were you born?
I would say about 4 to 5 months. I don't know if it was. Yeah, so I think I was supposed to be born in October and I was born in June. So that should, you know.
Yeah, that's so much. Yeah. I mean, the fact that your doctors were able to get you to this point is really incredible.
Yeah, that I would say my mom is a huge player in that.
Yeah.
I was born in Greenville, South Carolina. If you can imagine what that environmental landscape is like in 1991, they did not have a cutting edge healthcare system. No slight to the Greenville healthcare system, but in 91, they definitely didn't. And so my mom had to search the breadth of this country to find me the right doctor and the right specialist, and had to take me up to larger cities at some points to get me the treatment that I needed. I actually didn't get the diagnosis of Golden Heart Syndrome. I think it wasn't until I was 3 years old. So there was a lot of, because when I was born, the doctors didn't know what was wrong with me. They just knew the symptoms that I was exhibiting. And so it wasn't until much later that they actually began to put a name to, okay, well, she's having this symptom, or this is showing up, or this is needs to be corrected or fixed. And so my mom had a very big part. She is what I like to call the epitome of being a mama bear.
Yeah, she sounds like a total rock star to get you to this point. That's so incredible. Yeah. And, you know, having that support is so crucial. And my heart goes out to the people who don't have that support, because there's far too many people dealing with chronic illness and disability who don't have that support. Yeah. So it's so interesting that your medical trauma, you know, is sort of tapering off at 17, but then the social trauma really kicks up after that, because going through something so intense physically is enough, you know, like that is by far enough. You shouldn't have to deal with people treating you differently because of what you've already experienced. But unfortunately, society doesn't work that way. You know, we're fighting back. We're trying to change it. And I do think that we're making progress. You know, I think that in the last couple of years, society has sort of been opened wide, and so much of the ugliness is being sorted through, and we're trying to like excise and remove it. Yeah. It's like a tumor that's we're trying to cut around and pull out, but obviously that's huge, difficult work. Yeah. It's going to take generations. But I do feel like we made a big leap in the last couple of years, which is
absolutely,
you know, kind of incredible. But that unfortunately is after you go through this horrific period in your 20s.
Yeah.
And that disparity in what you should be experiencing and what you did experience is very upsetting. And that is something that would keep me up at night. How did that feel to go through that? Were you shocked when you kind of went out in the world and were treated the way you were?
I think shock alludes to a feeling like your expectation would have been something different. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was shock because I didn't know if it was anything different that I should be experiencing until I was able to take a step back and compare, like, oh, everyone doesn't go through this, or maybe it was just me going through this. I think it was a lot of disappointment because what I was told, you know, by either media, entertainment, from other people around me, what are normalized experiences, I was not experiencing. And so it was almost like I was disappointed because you said it's supposed to be like this at this mark, and I'm not hitting any of the marks. So how am I supposed to, like, how do you rationalize that? And so, yeah, there were many moments, and still there are moments where I'm like, up at night, like, dang, like, I don't get it. Like, I don't understand it, and trying to process it all. And I don't know if I will ever process it all in my lifetime because it's so layered. I don't know if I will ever process it all, but I think you just have to process it all in time.
It sounds almost like being in an abusive relationship that you can't get out of. Like, I'm curious about that moment of revelation when you recognize that you're not getting what is promised, you know, you're not living the American dream, that you are seeing the way like people are supposed to be treated on TV and in magazines and all this stuff, and you're not hitting those markers.
Yeah.
How do you recognize that something is wrong and that you need to make a change?
Yeah, I would say 2017 was a really integral part of me, I guess, waking up and realizing this is not normal and this is not right. And either I'm going to do something about it or I'm going to spend my life fighting to do something about it. In 2017, I had this really bad infection that wouldn't go away. Ended up me having to go out of state, back to my home state. I was living in Georgia at the time. And if anyone knows Georgia, Georgia doesn't have the greatest healthcare system. And so I was one of those Georgians that I wasn't poor enough to qualify or disabled enough to qualify, poor or disabled enough to qualify from any of the state services. But my employer at the time did not offer healthcare insurance. And so I fell in a crack in the gray area in which many Georgians are being uninsured. And because my state happened to be also one of the few states left in the U.S. that did not expand Medicaid, I was just basically left with no type of support care services. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up going back to California, where my parents were at the time, to get this medical treatment. And I found myself in an 18-month-long battle of the insurance company basically trying to approve a surgery that we all knew was medically necessary, but because the insurance code did not recognize the type of disability that I had and the treatment that I needed, they were constantly rejecting me and the services that I needed. Wow. I ended up getting the procedure in 2017 after fighting with the hospital. That procedure ended up just going bad as well. And they ended up having to do the procedure again. But then after I had the surgery and got what I needed for where I initially went to California for, I came back, the job that I had was gone. The car that I had was gone. I didn't have any income. I had this huge gap in my resume of being unemployed for basically over a year because I had left out on my job and short-term disability that ran out. The last disability check that I had my job fought me for 6 months and trying to get the last little $1,200 that they owed me on short-term disability. So all of these things are happening. It's just like one job after another, after another. And I finally was just like, this sucks. Mm-hmm. And no person should have to fight as hard as I'm fighting to keep my head above water. It was to the point that I was sleeping from home to house, from couch to couch, with my clothes and my car on the brink of, I was homeless at this point, you know, almost living out of my car and at the mercy of other people, uninsured, without a job, disabled. I was like, this sucks. This completely sucks and it's not right. And so I dove headfirst into advocacy, and I took all that indignation and all of that anger, and I said, I'm going to blow the whistle, and I'm going to put everything I have into making sure that my voice is heard and that no other people, if I could help it, is going to ever be treated like this again. And I'm still in that process.
Wow, that's incredible. How did that look for you when you jumped into advocacy? What pathways did you start to pursue first?
That's why I turned to social media. And that's why I started creating content. Because social media, as much as it's, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with social media. It's so great, but it can also be really toxic. We all know this.
Yeah.
But I started creating content because my first point of thought was like, I need people to hear my story. Because when they hear my story, they won't only hear me and my pain, but I know other people will be able to relate to this as well, because it can't just possibly be just Rashira. You know, that would be so prideful and arrogant for me to be like, oh, it's just me. You know, no, it was bigger than Rashira. It was Rashira types. People like me who are disabled, who are Black, who are the intersection of disability and being a part of BIPOC communities, who are disenfranchised, who are being consistently overlooked, undervalued, and not addressed at within our healthcare system, and that needed to change.
Yeah. So was it Facebook, Instagram? Where did you start?
Oh, man. I think I started, like, YouTube.
YouTube, yeah.
Oh, YouTube page. I don't think I was very successful with that. But then it was Facebook. All my friends and family on Facebook, they started sharing my thing. And then I got over to Instagram and just began to create more content. And then I began to do a lot of writing. Like, I wrote for a lot of blogs, for a lot of organizations, and just, like, writing, like, your patient story, patient's perspective thing. Like, I really got into that silo a little bit, and I just began to share my story. And then I crossed over to, like, doing some ambassador, like, you know, she's the ambassador for the month. Like, hear her story. You know, all those types of, like, campaign ads and different things that you see. And then I crossed over when I decided to go back to school. I crossed over to public health, and I began to get involved into research. And so then I'm building layers. I'm taking what I'm learning from school and building that into my content to bring more awareness. And it was just like the platforms. I started getting invitations to speak, to share my story. It all started out with me sharing my story on these smaller platforms, whether it was speaking to schools or different patient-led organizations about my lived experience. But as I was building my research skills, as I was building my narrative and sharing my story, then more organizations, more corporate companies, like, oh, you have something to say. We want to hear you. And so it was over the past probably 5 to 6 years has been me building and weaving and building and weaving all of these different intricate parts to tell a larger story, which is about how to advance the right of people with disabilities and the right way to do that. And then the podcast came. But me using different types of avenues and media platforms to keep echoing the same message, mm-hmm. which is messages of justice, advocacy, disability empowerment, awareness, and whoever wants to listen.
So you've gone through this period of being treated so poorly in your 20s because of being disabled, and then mm-hmm. you become a disability advocate, and now you are putting your face out there on social media, putting your message out, repeating these things that need to be said over and over. How did it compare to be fighting for yourself as a single individual trying to get through the world versus fighting on behalf of your community and then becoming a public figure on behalf of your community? What was the social impact of that? How did it compare?
I think the social impact started small and then it gradually grew over time. I think people were so used to seeing me in a certain model and in a certain way that when I began to cross over from not just telling my story, but being an expert in health policy or disability related things, it was almost kind of like, whoa, what are you doing here? Like, it took a lot of people off guard because everyone loves to patronize a disabled person who needs pity, right? Mm. But people fear the disabled person who is looking to not only empower, but to change systems. And so I think that took a period of adjustment for people to not just share my story because it was this cute, inspirational piece, but also to get them to awaken in their mindsets and to challenge their ideologies and their stereotypes behind disability. I think it challenged a lot of people and in a lot of good ways, in which I've had plenty of people like, you changed my mind about how I see disability, or I never thought about it that way. And I often say when I do speaking engagements, like, my goal is not to change the world. It's impossible for me to change the world. I'm just one person. But if I can change the mind of at least one person, then that one person is going to go tell another person and another person. And it creates this trifecta of now we have a whole group of people or a community of people thinking differently about disability. And if we can get enough people to think differently about disability, then that's how we can change policy. That's how we can influence research. That's how we can change systems. And so, like I said, the social impact, and that's the thing often people forget, there's a difference between being an influencer and making impact. My goal is to never be an influencer because trends come and go. My goal is to have impact so that 5, 10, 20 years from now, when I'm long gone and dead, that I will be able to have a mark here on this earth that says I was able to influence the way this outcome or this policy is impacting disparate communities. That is the goal. And one thing about being an activist or advocate, it's never about the immediate work. And so for me, I have 1,700 followers. That is like nothing compared to people who are like influencers, okay? But I have impact. When people want to know how to look at a certain community, how to do equity engaged research, how to reach people with disabilities, they call me. So for me, I think that is the best level of social impact. It's having that gradual change that builds into or adds to a larger movement that is taking place.
Are you getting bullied at all in your public work?
No, I don't think people have the nerve enough to bully me because they know I would probably call them out. Now, I will say people can be microaggressive, but those are typically people who don't know who I am.
Yeah, I've been surprised at how little bullying I see on my pages for Major Pain. I definitely get trolled and bullied on my other projects, you know, like I have a project where I green screen myself in old episodes of Star Trek because I'm a huge nerd, and I get like body shamed and, you know, people telling me I'm not funny and like some very mean comments, but I mean, overwhelmingly very, very positive, and it's great fun and I love it. But on Major Pain, you know, I've heard of some really horrible examples of people on social media being bullied for being chronic illness advocates, being accused of, you know, being attention seekers and faking their illness. And that really kept me from wanting to do this for a long time. Before I had a diagnosis, when I started this podcast, I was very, very touchy and sensitive about people recommending that I try things. Because it's always like, have you tried yoga? Are you gluten-free? Have you tried the keto diet? And I'm just like, I need every single one of you to shut your mouths. And I didn't want to put myself in that position. But I've been shocked how that doesn't happen that often, you know? And and the really dark side of the internet, I'm not really seeing it on my advocacy work, which is surprising me.
Yeah. Like I said, I've maybe gotten maybe 2 to 3 comments. I think that were just like one person, like, does she really have a disability? I'm just like, okay. And then I wrote one article around the leadership of Black women and disability, and someone called me racist. I was like, okay. You know?
What?
Yeah. Okay. Go figure it out. But overall, I don't think I've experienced a lot of bullying, which is, well, I don't know if people are too scared or maybe I'm not that important. I really don't care. which has been nice, but I also know that I have a strong community behind me, so I wish you would come on my page and say something crazy. You not only have me to deal with, you have my mother to deal with, and a lot of people who have a lot of deep love for me that are not nice like I am, so.
I'm curious about the conclusions you've drawn from doing your podcast, you know, discussing the intersection of being a woman and being disabled. What are sort of the generalities that you can share with us of what you've learned from doing that project?
Yeah, that's such a great question. A lot of generalities is that women with disabilities often feel silenced in expressing their struggles to people. And people don't often see womanhood and femininity and disability coexisting. They tend to separate that. So like the recent episode that just dropped, we talk about how I'm talking with a confidence coach who has a facial difference. And she was like, people don't often think that you can have a facial difference and be a fashionista, you know, and so much of who we are as women is attributed to our appearance, how we look, our sexuality, but people don't tend to think of all of those things in alignment also with our disabilities. And so having the space to say that, hey, I'm a woman with a disability and I'm still beautiful and I want to be seen in media representations and things like that. I'm a woman with a disability and I have a period. Like that's like, that totally blows people's mind. Like, or I'm a woman with a disability and I want to have children, or I'm having struggles dating, or questions about my sexuality. Like, a lot of things that I think on some level in American culture, we're still really taboo on because we don't talk about these things, and knowing that these things are also happening in our disabled bodies. And so I think those are some of the hierarching things that I'm hearing from our podcast guests, and that just women wanting more autonomy and more voice in the larger women empowerment space to say, hey, it's great being a woman and I'm glad that we're all here, but I'm here too. And these are my experiences. And if you're going to talk about women, you need to be talking about me too. So those are kind of some of the things that you can get from listening to our podcast.
Wow. I'm very excited to check it out. Are you comfortable sharing anything about how your journey has impacted your personal life? You know, dating and seeking intimacy can be so difficult when you are dealing with health challenges. That's something I've really lived through. My partner and I just got engaged after being together for 7 years, and the biggest barrier to us wanting to take that step has been my health. And overcoming that barrier has been very difficult and very powerful, and really showed us that we love each other and want to be together no matter what. And that, you know, was hard fought and almost broke us up in the middle of it. What's that been like for you?
To be completely honest, it's non-existent. And I laugh at it, but I probably cry more about it than I laugh about it. I feel like in my 20s, I didn't have any space to think about that part of my life because I was so busy fighting. And now in my 30s, I'm not fighting as much as I was in my 20s. So there's like this really big gap and this really large question of how do I do this? How do I date? How do I pursue romantic partnerships? How do I engage in a world that I've pretty much been excluded from? And I think it happens on multiple levels, on the disability level, but also the disability level compared with the Black level and the being educated level, and all these different layers that add to a story of just like, okay, like, how do I do this? How do I engage? And so I think it's something that I'm asking more questions about now, and that I'm not quite sure how to navigate. And I think that's an okay place to be at, but it is scary. It's very scary. And it's something that I'm having other conversations with other women who are disabled, and they're having the same questions. Like, how do we date in a world that is so superficial, and a society that says if you don't look a certain way, if your body type is not a certain way, that you're not attractive, that you're not worthy of being married? Like, how do you confront those beliefs? And how do you carve out for your own? And so I think that's just my truth. And I hope that that truth changes over time. I'm hopeful that it does. But as of right now, I've been single, and not that I don't want to be, but it's just been very hard for me to kind of unpack that and show the world who I am outside of my disability identity, but as someone who is a person who desires companionship.
Wow. I really appreciate you sharing that with us. And I have full confidence that that will change for you, because you obviously have so much to offer in a partnership. How do you separate yourself from your online personality?
People are used to us sharing levels of vulnerability online, but being vulnerable in person requires another level of access that everyone doesn't have.
Yeah.
And I had to learn this the hard way. Just because I'm vulnerable online, I'm sharing what I choose to give to you. But if we're in friendship or anything like that, there are other layers of vulnerability that you have to earn access to those places in my life, because they're even more protected, you know? And most of the content and things I post online are things that I have clearly processed through. You didn't see the behind the scene work. Like, so I did, I think last year I dropped an episode on dating with a disability, and I kind of talked a lot about what that's like. And I did a very vulnerable like episode. Like, I was crying, and I might do a part two actually now that I think about it. But I had posted that episode months after I had that initial encounter of a really bad dating experience that I had. It's never immediate in which I'm sharing my vulnerability with you. But in person, you have to earn access to it. I just don't let anyone come into my space and like, oh, we're going to be friends. Like, no, like, I have to trust you, because I do realize like the level of vulnerability and the public facingness that I have, like, you have to be able to handle my weakness along with my strength. And some people can only handle when you're weak. Not everybody can handle when you're strong. So that's something I've had to learn too.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. So you've been on quite a journey.
Yeah.
And it's changed you in so many ways. And I can really feel that in the last couple of years, you've started to cultivate this strength from your journey. Is that true? What are the ways in which your journey has changed you for the better?
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head. I've been able to pull the strength. I've been able to pull vision in how I want to live my life rather than how people are saying I should live my life. It's given me a sense of independence to kind of break up the stereotypes and break up the box and create my own box, or my own lane for that matter, in which I probably didn't have the confidence to do that 5 years ago, because I was kind of still in the thick of it. And so I think, yeah, it has really changed me in a way that I appreciate my authenticity, because like I said, trends and fads and personalities, they come and go, but authenticity is something that will never go out of style. And so I've really just embraced that aspect of, it always pays to be authentically yourself. It always pays to just be integral and to be honest. Even if you're not being put on all the platforms or getting all the likes and the follows, people appreciate when you're being with yourself, because they know that it's trustworthy. They can trust it. And so I've learned to really trust more in myself and the lessons that my journey has taught me. And those lessons are so universal that I can take them with me wherever I go. And I don't really have to fear any challenge or any bad thing that may come my way or any surgical procedure, because I have so much in my tool belt working for me that I was like, no, I can flip that around and use it for my good. Or, yeah, it was bad, or it hurt my feelings, or that was really crappy what they say. But you know what? I've been here before. And so I know how to get through it. And I know how to get through it better and stronger than not letting it completely destroy me. So I think those are really good things that has allowed me to reframe how I interact and engage with the world and how I deal with conflict.
Wow. Yeah. So incredible. I have one more question for you. It kind of piggybacks off that last one. I love ending the podcast with a sci-fi thought experiment. So,
oh my gosh,
you're going to hop in a time machine. Here we go. So we're going back in time. Let's go back to your 20s, your early 20s, when you have gone out on your own and the world is just being horrible to you and not treating you the way you deserve. And let's think about that toolkit you just talked about building. What are the tools that you pull out of that toolkit and hand to yourself in your early 20s when you go back in time to meet with yourself?
One of the tools is resilience. It's cliche, but it's the truth. Resilience does build character. And then I will also say to my 20-year-old self, another tool that I would use is power. Don't ever give your power away. I had to learn that lesson. No one should ever have that much power over you to make you feel so small. The minute that you get to that point, you've given too much of your power away. Mm. And so knowing that you are a powerful being within yourself, and that you can control how people control you. You know, you don't have to let people treat you or talk to you any type of way. You have power to speak back to that and say, no, you're wrong. This is what I'm going to say about me, and this is what I'm going to allow you to say about me. And so I would say resilience and power, and just being able to stand on those two things, I think it's something that my 20-year-old self definitely could have benefited from.
Wow, that's so cool, because I can sense that since you stopped giving your power away, you've started to collect it. And you've got this locked chest full of power that is yours. And just like we were talking about how joy is cumulative, so is giving away your power.
Oh, yeah.
And when you stop giving it away, you start to cultivate it for yourself. And there's so much power in what you're doing right now and what you're putting into the world. Your writing, your podcasting, your social media presence, your advocacy. And there's so much of it. It's so incredibly cool. I'm extremely impressed. I love what you're doing. I've loved talking to you today so much. Please tell our audience where they can go to connect with you online or anything you'd like to plug.
Yeah, thank you. I've enjoyed this episode. You asked some really great questions.
Oh, thank you.
I was like, man, this is really making me sweat a little bit. but yeah, you guys can follow me on Instagram at Rashir Dobson. And also I have an Instagram page for the podcast, the Womanhood and Disability Podcast. For all you professionals out there, I'm on LinkedIn under Rashir Dobson. A lot of professional content there. I'm on TikTok too. Not like really a big TikToker, but I post some thought-provoking conversations every now and then. So yeah, those are the platforms you can find me at. And then if any of those platforms you want to talk more, engage more, always feel free to reach out. I'm pretty responsive to most people who reach out. Just don't be creepy. But yeah.
Major Payne also uses TikTok and Instagram, so I'll be sure to tag you on those platforms. What a gift to share yourself and share your journey the way you have today. I'm really blown away by your openness, and I've learned so much. I'm so impressed by your advocacy work. It's, you know, for me personally, doing something similar, it's really inspiring to talk to you and grounding to talk to you. And, you know, you are coming from a similar place, and it's reminding me why I do what I do and to keep my focus in the right place. And that's such a gift. But also, we learned about two conditions I've never heard of before. And you did such an incredible job painting the picture of both of your conditions, Golden Haar and Vader syndrome, which I had no idea what those were an hour ago. So I'm so grateful for that. And I cannot wait to see where you go in the future.
Oh, well, thank you. From one podcaster to another, we're all here in solidarity. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Major Payne. I'm Jesse Mercury, your host and the producer of this podcast. Artwork by Egg Salad Salad. Our theme music is the song Time Machine from my sci-fi synth-pop album, available at jessemercury.bandcamp.com. Send your thoughts or questions to our email address, majorpainpodcast@gmail.com. You can also use that address to find us on PayPal. Tips are greatly appreciated. Don't forget to leave a positive rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the podcast platform of your choice. Find more information about this show or leave a comment on any episode at our website, majorpainpodcast.com. Major Payne is supported by listeners on Patreon. Thank you to our $2 per month supporters, our $7 per month patrons Naomi Adele Smith, Sunny Roberts, Laura Stevens, Kelsey Madsen, All Around Foundation Waterproofing, Alexandria Henderson, Justin Minnick, Heather Muncy, and Robert, and our $25 per month producers Steve Kavanaugh, Chris Fowler, Trish O'Brien, and Hipster Leia. Learn how you can support the show while receiving special recognition, gifts, and monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/majorpainpodcast.